Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Archaeological Society of Malta entitled War in the Bronze Age. This talk was delivered by Professor Anthony Harding from the University of Exeter.
Thank you very much, and especially thank you for the invitation to come and talk to you. The meeting we had last September was magnificent, not least thanks to Tricia and to Tony Bonanno here, and it will always stay in our memories as one of the best EAA conferences ever. So it was a great success. You don't need to have any worries on that score. Now, to turn to my theme tonight, War in the Bronze Age. And I have to say that although the images you have in front of you here depict some Bronze Age people on boats, I'm not going to be talking about anything to do with Malta at all. I'm afraid that this lecture was prepared for other purposes initially, and I haven't come across anything particularly relevant from Maltese archaeology with which I could regale you about on war in the Bronze Age, but maybe you'll tell me at the end that I'm wrong. So, to begin, I start with this traumatic image of a lot of people thrown into a pit or a ditch at a site in Central Europe around about 1400 BC or a little later. They were thrown in disorder into these pits, and some of them had wounds to the neck, the head, or other parts of the body. And of course it's not what one expects from a normal burial site of the Bronze Age or any other period. So what was going on? Are we looking at the result of some kind of lethal action, something we could call war? Were these people killed in fighting, or was it some kind of massacre? What exactly was going on? And when we look at other kinds of evidence from the period, you take examples of some of the rock art here in northern Italy, and you ask yourself, what are these people up to? I hope you can see some of the detail. There are people waving spears, quite a lot of them waving spears. Some of them may be hunting animals, we don't know. There are animals there as well. Are they engaged in something that we might call warfare? Well, of course, we can't directly answer that, but we need to establish a few parameters first. First of all, what do we mean by warfare in this sort of context? Well, here's one definition that's been used. You'll find many if you look at the literature. So this one, planned confrontations between groups of people who conceive of themselves as member of separate political communities or factions. So warfare is organized and sanctioned group violence that involves armed conflict, including confrontations which combatants recognize may result in deliberate killing. Conflicts are organized and carried out by at least one of the factions with the intent of maintaining the status quo or bringing about a shift of power relations, usually the latter. So the key word really, or key words, are conflict, aggression, and violence. War is a rather modern term. Well, obviously it's not just modern, historic, but it's not something we might imagine being applied to the Bronze Age, at least not to parts of it. But maybe war is something more like this famous ethnographic film called Dead Birds, not to be confused with the horror film of the same name of a few years ago, depicted what we can call warfare, something like it, in West Irian, part of New Guinea, and it's very intriguing as a possible analogy for what might have been going on in the periods I'm going to be talking about. The conflicts in this society were usually over pigs and women, much less often over land rights, and support was sought by groups from neighbors to form a confederation. Hostilities went on for long periods, but the fighting itself was sporadic. There were formal battles in designated areas, as well as surprise raids, and that's why you have these watchtowers being built so that you don't get caught out by a surprise raid. The encounters were quite bloody, but fatalities were rare. And typically, the day would end with a few wounded warriors, and the actual fighting would typically only last 10 to 15 minutes, with about 200 men on each side, and what went on was actually the shouting of insults rather than actually anything more lethal than that. And if anyone died, it was usually because of infection subsequently rather than actually receiving a lethal blow at the time. So, and if someone did die, then that triggered all sorts of things. You had to have reprise raids and all that sort of thing. So there's lots of aggressive behaviour, but nothing very much that you could call as really what we might call warfare. But, well, who knows, maybe that is a good analogy for what went on in ancient times. I'm going to be talking about Europe generally, continental Europe mostly. And in that period, what we're not talking about is what you see depicted on this Egyptian relief of the Battle of Kadesh in 1285, where you've got massed armies with chariots and horses and all the rest of it. Yes, of course, there was something like organized warfare going on in the Near East at this time, but not in what we might call barbarian Europe. And even if we look at something like Mycenaean Greece, where we've got plentiful evidence for the arrival of the chariot here being pulled by what is presumably a horse, we don't know for sure that these were being used take warriors into battle rather than just to hunt animals. Certainly the latter was one thing they were doing. So Bronze Age Europe was on an altogether smaller scale than this. And if we look at the sort of size of the settlements and try to estimate what the population might have been, we're talking about maybe tribal groups of a few hundreds or thousands of people, and any war groups were probably numbered in the scores, at the most in the hundreds. It seems to be what we can depict. Now, in the Aegean, yes, we can point to lots of warriors all around the place. A depiction from a fresco here, a chap with his spear carrying a shield, and the famous suit of armor from Dendera, with various detachable bits of it, incredibly heavy to wander around with. It's been debated whether you could actually do anything carrying this immensely heavy suit of armor. Interestingly, the helmet is made of boar's tusks and not of metal at all. And then, of course, there's this famous vase, which I think appeared on the poster for this lecture, the warrior vase from Mycenae, quite late in the Bronze Age, after 1200 BC, and what is a procession of warriors, presumably soldiers, being waved goodbye by this lady on the left, marching off to battle, we assume. When you look at them, I think one would probably fancy your chances against that lot, really, wouldn't you? They're very sort of weedy individuals. And they've got, notice what they're carrying, they're all carrying a spear. They've got a helmet with horns on the front. We'll see more of that in a minute. And they've got a small round, well, it's not quite round, it's got a bit cut out the bottom, shield. And then they've got something on their legs, on their shins, greaves. So they're quite well equipped. And, well, we don't know exactly the context that something like this might have occurred in. Turning to central parts of Europe, we can go back to the Copper Age, going back to 2500, 3000 BC, quite a lot earlier. And you get these anthropomorphic gravestones or stelae, like this famous one from a site in Switzerland, where the depiction of what sort of anthropomorphized stone grave slab shows this person is carrying a bow. So he was, we don't know, but there's no indication that it's not a he. This must have been an archer, And that, of course, is certainly the case for many, many Bronze Age warriors. And there are others from the Alpine area, like this one from northern Italy. You can see, if anyone comes to the European Association meeting this year in Riva del Garda, you'll see this magnificent piece in the museum at Riva. So this person, who's depicted in very schematic form, has multiple daggers, these things, which we would call halberds, and other things like, well, we don't know quite what they are, but presumably depicting weapons to be used either against people or against animals. And that's really part of the thing. How do we tell what they are meant to be used for? And then you can find, you know, depictions of people. This character, who's waving an enormous battle axe. What was he using the battle axe for? Was he going to go and hit people with it? Or was he just waving it around in some kind of display? Well, there are many, many depictions of this general kind, especially from Scandinavia. Or from Valcamonica in northern Italy here. Sorry, it's rather hard to make out, but what appears to be some kind of fight going on between two people, maybe with a referee in the middle there. This character apparently holding a sword raised to strike his opponent. And we can find plenty of other evidence of at least weaponry and armor. Famous bronze figurines from Sardinia, for instance. Charming little things. I'm afraid there's no scale, but they're quite small, about so high typically. This one, back in front, he's got a shield carrying on his back, and he's carrying a club, or a mace, or something like that, and he's got a helmet with horns on. This person, obviously an archer, you notice he's also got something attached to his belt. And this one, this charming little person, has got a great spear, got a horned helmet, and he's got a dog on a lead. It's very, very sweet. I mean, why they, presumably didn't go into battle with his dog, but who knows. Maybe they just, these people went around carrying their spears all the time. Now then, so we've got depictions, we've got archaeological sites, as we'll see in a minute, and there's another category of evidence that tells us about what we can call warfare, and that's trauma, pathological features on bones, on skeletons coming from the period. Here you can see a spearhead embedded in an unfortunate person's vertebra, one of them. This comes from a site in Germany. This burial from a cemetery in Hungary has something similar, a spear embedded in this person's pelvis. So these people had obviously been on the receiving end of something nasty. In what context, we don't know, but certainly violence going on. An intriguing example comes from Stonehenge, found some years ago. This body belongs to the Beaker period, so around about 2000 BC, sitting in the ditch, and was found with what's usually called a wrist guard, doesn't matter, but it's found with a series of arrowheads, so maybe he was an archer, but, interestingly, one of the arrowheads was found embedded in a rib. So it puts the idea of grave, gives a completely different complexion to the idea of grave goods buried with a person, if you're actually their cause of death. It's not really grave goods at all. This person seems to have been standing by the ditch, was shot, and tumbled into it, and left there. We don't know why. And one more example of this, from a site in England, Tormarton, where more than one individual had a series of wounds, spearhead there, a mark on the pelvis there, and again there. So a number of someone been on the receiving end of a lot of different things going on there. And you will be familiar with Ötzi the Iceman, or you no doubt all know his name. I'm not going to dwell on him here, but just to remind you, if you hadn't heard, that of course the more recent analysis by the Italian specialists established that he had an arrowhead in his left shoulder, which probably caused him to bleed to death. So he was on the receiving end. He was carrying a quiver of arrows and a bow, but they were not ready to use. And he'd apparently come from the Italian side of the Alps and had gone up to a height of about 3,000 meters before lying down and expiring up there, probably from loss of blood. So he's a bit earlier still. He's before 3,000 BC, but it sort of shows you that people they're at it from really quite an early period, shooting each other, hitting each other with spears. But the trouble is we don't know the context. Can we call it war? Is it just interband conflict of some kind, or just interpersonal conflict? Well, I think we're now in a position where we can paint quite a detailed picture, actually, of what was going on. And I think it's possible to detect a process by which the warrior changed from being a hunter to being a real warrior, and then turned into something which I'll explain a little bit more in a minute, not just an individual warrior, but part of a warrior band. Now, we saw the bow and arrow earlier on, or indeed we've seen it with the Iceman, that the dagger starts off the process of the development of weaponry. The dagger takes over, it becomes very elaborate, as you see from these bronze examples here from the early part of the Bronze Age, somewhere between 2000 and 1600 BC. The spearhead follows soon after, and then, perhaps most important of all, the sword gets developed. And once you get the sword coming into existence, sometime around about 1500 BC, I think we can start to see a sea change at that point, because the sword is, it's often been said, the sword is the first implement of war that seems to have been developed specifically for use against other people, not just against animals. I mean, bows and arrows, daggers, you can interpret them, or even spears, you can interpret them as hunting implements, but not the sword. That has to be for use against other people. So once that happens, in the middle of the second millennium BC, we witness a complete change. And swords become extremely common, so do other things like spearheads as well. Of course, one of the curious things is that Bronze Age people had this funny habit of throwing away their bronze into rivers and streams and bogs and things, and maybe even the sea. And that's what this slide is meant to represent. And I think that process of throwing bronze away was at least in some places connected with the idea of the warrior, what the warrior did. We'll see again in a little while. Then, as well as weapons for hurting other people with, you wanted to protect yourself when you engage in this, so you develop armor. And here you see the helmet and the cuirass or corselet. These are relatively late part of the Bronze Age, but a thing like this is obviously a magnificent affair, probably more for parade and display than actual fighting in. But, well, it obviously started life as something you fought in. That comes from France, that particular example. Shields, quite a lot of shields known, though, curiously enough, most of them come from the extreme west of Europe, especially Ireland. Bronze shields like this, of which there are several score. And not only bronze shields, but also leather shields, a leather shield here, and curiously, even more curious, what appears to be a wooden shield. These are both from Ireland. That's because of the preservation in the bogs of Ireland. You get the organic materials surviving. it's been suggested that this thing here is not actually a functional shield, but a former, something that you pressed leather over to make a leather shield from. Well, the interesting thing about shields is to ask yourself how effective they were. A thing like this, highly elaborate, enormous skill by the bronze smith, I defy you to actually count up how many of these little bosses or punch dots there are. Enormous numbers, I mean, incredible skill involved. This one, rather more functional, and this one actually saw action because there, see it enlarged here, is a hole from a spearhead. It's got the typical profile, this section of a Bronze Age spearhead that's been thrust or thrown at the person carrying this shield. And there are, in fact, quite a number of the shields do have damage on them from fighting. So, you know, they were certainly being used. There certainly were people going around wielding swords and throwing spears. But how effective were they? Famous experiment done a long time ago now, 45 years, by John Coles, established that there's a big difference between bronze shields and leather shields in this respect. And in the past, when I give this lecture in Britain, others don't have to go on an aeroplane, I'm usually able to carry a sword and a shield with me to demonstrate this point. I thought that Malta would probably not be happy with me bringing my Bronze Age spear with me, sword with me. But anyway, you see the effect of simulated warfare here with a bronze sword striking a reconstructed bronze shield and literally cutting it straight down with one blow, which suggested to John Coles that bronze shields were not usually very effective and were probably more for use in parade and display than for actual fighting. He established, in fact, that fighting, here he is using a leather shield here, for fighting, this was much more effective. He made reconstructions of both, tried them out with one of the technicians in the department, survived in this one, whereas in that one, he was lucky to get away with his life, so to speak. So those are the sort of general categories of evidence that we've got to deal with. And what I want to do now is turn to some rather specific evidence from a site that I was fortunate enough to be involved with for a few years in the 1990s, but the analysis of which was only completed relatively recently, a few years ago. Because this is a site of the Bronze Age, the Middle Bronze Age, and I showed you a picture at the beginning, it dates to about 1400, 1300 BC, where there is an extraordinary amount of very informative evidence that tells us rather specifically what was going on. It's on a low hill with a double enclosure ditch going round it. You see it on their photograph here. And this slide shows the overall arrangement here. The double ditches you saw just now are over there. This is all from geophysics, showing a ditch going right round this massive, going under the modern village, something like a kilometre that way and probably half a kilometre in that direction, a huge enclosed area. The main part of the site is over here. That's where excavation has taken place, as you can see from this slide. So we were looking at the double ditches out there. The excavation has taken place there, and geophysical survey around there. Unfortunately, a lot of the site is destroyed by quarrying and a couple of modern houses over there. So there's a lot we don't know and never will know. But when we look at the actual plan in more detail, we can see a number of important features. There's an outer fortification line going around here, consisting of a wide, not very deep ditch. It was called an excavation, the Red Ditch, because it was filled with bright red and pink material, as you'll see in a moment. And then inside that was a series of large pits. And inside that, again, another double ditch with a palisade running round inside that. Sorry, I should have said that there's a palisade going round inside the outer fortification as well. I'm going to show you a couple of pictures from this ditch here. It's an extremely complex site, so I'm only going to dwell on a few aspects of it. I'm going to show you some pictures from this pit here, known as Ditch 64, and I'm going to show you a picture of this outer fortification line. This is this pit from Ditch 64, which I mentioned before. You see a series of slides in excavation. Big, big thing. See from the preceding one how deep it was, with the four diggers standing near the bottom, and here it is completely dug out. Well, that's just one of the features. It was had a lot of bone in it, including this unfortunate child. I mean, it's very sad to look at these images, actually, because this child was, although he looks to be sort of sitting up, in fact, he was just thrown into the thing in a crumpled position and covered over. And there are a number of children present. There are no wound marks on this child, but of course you don't necessarily expect to see wound marks on the bone, especially when the bones are as soft as they are in a child, in young children. And this is a very young child under the age of one. And there are many others, as we'll see in a minute. The outer fortification barely looks like a fortification at all. The ditch is not very deep, and it appears to have had a rampart built over here, which might have been more functional. And I bet you can't see the colours terribly well in this picture, but it's full of burnt material, burnt pink and white, that had collapsed from the rampart, it seems, in a great conflagration. And in the pits, round and about, are all these jumbled up skeletons. And as I said before, some of them have wounds on them. And when you look at, let's go back to that previous one, when you look at an arrangement like that, it reminds one very strongly of a historically attested massacre site, from, in this case from North America, Crow Creek in South Dakota, where large numbers of you probably can't read the caption, but it says nearly 500 men, women and children dating to 1325, showing signs of warfare through the mutilation and scalping of the dead. Well, it seems that the masses of bones that we've got up on the site in the Czech Republic look very similar to that. And they weren't just people being killed. There were strange things going on. I mean, this looks like a skull cult, though in fact they weren't even skulls, they're crania, in other words, the top part, without the jaw, without the mandible. So these had obviously been collected up post-mortem. It wasn't just they were beheading people, though they might have been doing that as well. Because our osteoarchaeologists have been at work on the bones that we excavated, and have shown a number of particular pathological traits. This mandible has got a wound at that point there, and the specialist interprets that as a beheading attempt. Not very grisly, this. This person has got a depressed skull fracture, and this one has got cut marks on his thigh. So, you know, and these are some of many. So, you know, there's lots going on here, not just ordinary people dying. Then there are arrowheads, like that, and they're found particularly around the outer fortifications. It's these black triangles we're looking at here. Some of them further inside, but these were all found by our Czech colleagues. In my excavations, we didn't find a single arrowhead, as it happens, but then we were mainly concentrating on the deep pits. So there are lots of arrowheads, and presumably they came from arrows that had been unleashed at the site, at the defenders, at the time of the fatal attack. So that's what I'm going to say about that particular site, but I think you'll agree that it gives us something of a window into what might have been going on at that particular spot in that particular period. Doesn't mean to say it happened like that everywhere. Now, to broaden it out slightly, everyone had access to, or at any rate, everyone in the Bronze Age after the early stages would have known what weaponry looked like. And they did, apart from some people carrying swords and spears and armor, there was obviously also a big fad for collecting these bronzes, especially weapons, though not only, and dumping them in the ground. And this is one of the enduring mysteries or fascinations of the Bronze Age, why people allowed so much of their metal to be lost to them forever. I can't go now into the possible reasons why people did this, but there have been many reasons suggested. One of them being that people were stashing stuff away in times of trouble. I don't think myself that's right, but anyway, they did it, and they did it many times over. And weapons were especially used for this purpose, either whole or fragments. And there's some grounds for thinking that all this is part of what happened when you were a Bronze Age warrior. Sometimes you get people buried with swords, in Germany for instance, though never in Britain and Ireland. Sometimes the swords get put in hordes of bronze. And that's what this distribution map of the Alpine area is intended to show. Here's northern Italy, here's the Alps running across here. The round circles are hoard finds containing a sword, and the squares are graves containing a sword. And you can see they broadly are complementary. So people had a choice. They could either get themselves buried with a sword, or they could put the sword into a hoard and shove it in the ground. Probably two sides of the same coin, and what it meant when you were a Bronze Age warrior. Now, in the last part of this talk, I just want to introduce a rather new topic, and that is what happened in the later stages of the Bronze Age. And in particular, can we say there were new styles of fighting going on, and did the concept of the warrior developed into something new, what I called here the warrior band or the war band. The war band means, we know it mostly from Iron Age and Roman contexts and indeed medieval contexts, but it's described to us, for instance, by Tacitus in his Germania. It's basically a leader, a powerful leader, who attracts round him a group of young men, young warriors, whose sole purpose is to bring glory and honor to their leader. So we get the idea of the war band, usually called in German the Männerbund, and it's been much studied. Now, this presumably didn't come about overnight, and the new styles of fighting that I think we see happening as the war band develops are connected with not only the development of weaponry but also the move to create fortified sites, and along with that the idea that you have these war bands based in a tribal society interacting with each other on a fairly large scale. So we can go back to the earliest stages of the Bronze Age, or the Copper Age, before 2000, and see what we might call, as this slide says, the beaker warrior assemblage, the beaker being the famous pan-European type of pot, the archery material, and the dagger in this person's grave. And there are many, many examples of this sort of thing and the recent find of this individual, the so-called Amesbury Archer near Stonehenge, is the sort of classic of this type of appearance. This is the reconstruction of what he might have looked like. We know that he limped, he had an old wound. Of course, the other intriguing thing about this individual was that he came from somewhere on the European continent in adulthood. Now, he wasn't born in Britain, but he died there. We'll talk about that later if anyone's interested. He had with him an extraordinary range of stuff, an unparalleled amount of stuff. He's got three flat daggers or knife daggers, a whole series of arrowheads, sharpeners or wrist guards. And he also had his hair apparently in these golden tresses. Yeah, he had his hair, a nice hairdo with the people used to think these are earrings, but they would be very ineffective as earrings. They're much more likely to be tress rings. So, you know, special adornment for a warrior. And this warrior ethos gets more marked in the next part of the Bronze Age, when dagger graves become the norm. And this person here, the dagger's rather corroded, but never mind, it's a nice dagger. It's got a whetstone here, a battle axe, completely non-functional, it wouldn't be any use for fighting with. As you can see, it's completely blunt, it's never been sharpened, it's just a sign of status. And curiously, a cup made of amber. Lots of fascinating things there, but talking about warfare here. Time goes on, get into the Middle Bronze Age, we start to see swords being placed in graves, and we get to the latest parts of the Bronze Age, elite warriors, with this guy with his sword. And notice he's got this elaborate bronze vessel. Well, he's also got a great quantity of personal equipment. And this is, I think, important when we think about who the warrior was, what his identity was. He's got his tweezers, he's got his razor, he's got beads forming a necklace, he's got finger rings. He was obviously extremely careful. This thing here, like a sort of palette knife. It's sometimes been believed to be a tattooing implement. He was a comb, too. He was actually very careful about his appearance, this individual. It's usually called the king's grave. Well, we don't know if it was a king, of course. But he was a warrior who probably spent as much time in front of the mirror as he did on the war field. Well, he might or might not have looked like that. We don't know. He can't have looked quite like that because this person's got a beard and that guy had a razor. So he wasn't quite like that. But here he is with his sword, his shield, his body armor and so on. And that's presumably the aftermath of what he'd been up to. And this marking of people's identity is, you can see in the rock art and in the grave stele, in this case round the Mediterranean. Here, if any of you have been to the magnificent site of Filiosa in Corsica, these great grave slabs, really, aren't they? They're stele, depicting in a highly stylized form, although a hundreds of years later, what's left of a head, whether that's a nose or something, I don't know, but the sword prominently down the person's middle, and a dagger there at his waist. Well, it's not really waisted, this person, but assume it's at his waist. And over in Spain, depicted on this grave stele, a shield, just like the real examples we've seen, a spear down the side there, and a dagger there. And sometimes there are, he's got a horned helmet on as well. So he's depicted in his full panoply and placed there nearby this steeler. So the individual is important. This is what I think that we're seeing as the warrior who is the leader in charge of a war band. And it's just at this time that forts become very common. And I think we can see a connection between forts and war bands, because the forts, I think, are being built as a protection against raiding. And what we're seeing is a change from fights between individual warriors to fighting based on raiding bands. That's why I think forts developed so strongly after about 1200, and that's the time when we see the prestige individual warrior developing, along with large quantities of weaponry which would have served for the members of the warband. So we end up then with images like this. Here we are back in the Scandinavian rock art. We see these guys wandering around with their battle axes, they've got their swords. Are they engaged? What are they doing? Are they engaged in some ceremonial dance, some war dance? Or are they perhaps part of a war band? Well, probably the latter, I think. And these are the guys who are engaged in the service of what we might call the big man, the people who we saw on the grave stele a moment ago, and who are depicted here colossally, far more than life-size, on a piece of Swedish rock art. Here he is, he's enormous. Well, that's 1 meter there, so you can see he's pretty big. He's got his arms upraised, and he's carrying a spear in his right hand. So the picture I'm tried to depict is of one of a progression from a hunting society where people had bows and arrows, and if they had knives or knife daggers, they were at least as useful for dispatching a wounded animal as for sticking into another person, through to a situation where the warrior becomes more and more formalized and eventually ends up in a war band presided over by a leader marked out by these insignia of office, these signs of prestige identity, and living in, or at least retreating to, forts, which became such a common feature of the Bronze Age landscape after about 1200 BC. Thank you very much for your attention.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Archaeological Society of Malta entitled War in the Bronze Age. This talk was delivered by Professor Anthony Harding from the University of Exeter.